We're going to skip down a little bit and resume with Oglesby's article. After Galen surrendered to the United States, Oglesby resumes the narrative here, saying, "Recognition was inevitable, however, since the Counterintelligence Corps was trying to find him, him being Galen. By mid-June at the latest, his name was recognized by a G2 officer, Colonel William H. Quinn, who had Galen brought to Augsburg for his first serious interrogation. Quinn was the first American to whom Galen presented his proposal and told of his staff dispersed at several camps in the mountains as well as the precious buried archives of the FHO. Unlike Captain Porter, Colonel Quinn was impressed. He promptly passed Galen up the command chain to General Edwin L. Siebert, S-I-B-E-R-T. Siebert later recalled, quote, "I had a most excellent impression of him at once," unquote. Galen immediately began educating him as to, quote, "the actual aims of the Soviet Union and its display of military might," unquote. As Siebert told a journalist years later, quote, "With her present armed forces potential," he, Galen, continued, "Russia could risk war with the West, and the aim of such a war would be the occupation of West Germany," unquote. Next week, we're going to see just how absolutely wacky that very concept was. One of the main ways that Galen was able to influence the post-World War II world, the Cold War, and one of the things which ultimately led to what I view, and I think I can substantiate this as the conquest of the United States, was the grossly exaggerated view that Galen presented of Soviet capabilities and intentions. And this ultimately, over the years, led to, and we will talk about this next week and the following, led to the bankrupting not just of the Soviet Union, which from the enormous arms race, but it also led to the bankrupting of the United States as well. The Soviet Union collapsed. We're merely a basket case at this time. But continuing here with the Oglesby's account, "Acting without orders, Siebert listened to Galen for several days before informing Eisenhower's chief of staff, General Walter Bedell Smith," Bedell is B-E-D-E-L, or perhaps Bedell. "Smith and Siebert then continued to develop their relationship with Galen secretly, choosing not to burden Eisenhower with knowledge of what they were doing, quote, in order not to compromise him in his relations with the Soviets," unquote. Eisenhower, in fact, had strictly forbidden U.S. fraternization with Germans. Now, I'm going to interrupt here at this point, and we're going to go back to the Hona Zöhrling book, The General Was a Spy, about Reinhard Galen. Now, note here that the individual, and this is an individual that Galen formally credits with his rise, the individual who first established significant contact with Galen was the aforementioned General Edwin L. Siebert, again, S-I-B-E-R-T. And it is not presented either in here or most of the other accounts of Galen, but we're going to take a look at just how it was that General Siebert came to view the incorporation of German officers, and obviously one of them, Reinhard Galen, as a useful thing for the American military and intelligence system to do in preparation for the post-war period. Returning once again to The General Was a Spy by Hona and Zöhrling, "So there entered Galen's life," this about General Edwin Siebert, "so there entered Galen's life, the man primarily responsible for furthering the post-war career of the one-time Wehrmacht general. Edwin Luther Siebert, born in 1897, was an artillery expert, an ex-military attaché, and a professor of military science. Like Galen, he had entered the Secret Service world late in life. Since March of 1944, Siebert had been chief of intelligence to the 12th U.S. Army Group, which later advanced through France, and he had studied the ideas of the German military. While fighting was still in progress in France, he had been prepared to make use of Adolf Hitler's officers in the cause of American strategy. The idea had come from the German-American Gero von Gevernitz, advisor to Alan W. Dulles, the U.S. Secret Service officer in Bern. In November of 1944, Gevernitz had suggested to Siebert that, via certain intermediaries, he should contact war-weary German commanders at the front and urge them to surrender. Siebert combed the POW camps for German officers willing to contact their fellow officers still fighting, and he had soon assembled an adequate number willing to assist the Allies to bring the war to an end. So the individual who influenced General Siebert to pursue the policy which incorporated Galen was none other than the very Gero von Gebernitz, the assistant to Alan Dulles, who we looked at in the material from the Old Boys. Gero von Gebernitz, whose sister married Edmund Stinnes, and who himself was deeply involved with the transatlantic financial and industrial axis, which was central to the development of fascism. Gero von Gebernitz, acting, of course, as an agent for the Canaris Group, was also basically working as a triple agent and channeling espionage information back to the Third Reich. And it was through the contacts of Gero von Gebernitz and Hans Bernd Gisevius, a Canaris person who retained his rank in the SS, a Gestapo lawyer, and the awareness on the part of the Sicherheitsdienst, Schellenberg, and the SS, and Himmler and other Nazi functionaries of this so-called resistance group, the plotters against Hitler, and how useful they could be for political purposes. Ultimately, this led, once again, at the risk of seeming repetitive, to the contact between Prince Max von Hohenlohe and Alan Dulles, von Hohenlohe acting as an SS emissary, and out of that again grew the Christian West concept, the seed idea for NATO, and Galen leapt right in the middle of this, quote, Christian West, and he was able to direct it in a most un-Christian fashion. So again, the importance of Gero von Gebernitz and this transatlantic financial and industrial axis is front and center here, and it is more than a little interesting to find where Edwin L. Siebert just happened to pick up this particular little idea. It doesn't appear to be an accident at all. Continuing now with Carl Oglesby's account. Galen was encouraged to resume contact with his FHO comrades who were still at large in Bavaria. Galen was encouraged to resume contact with his FHO comrades who were still at large in Bavaria, releasing them from their vow of silence. Galen was sufficiently confident of his American relationships by this time that he dug up his buried files and, in special camps, put his FHO experts to work preparing detailed reports on the Red Army for his American captors. Well before the end of June, he and his comrades were, quote, discharged from prisoner of war status so that we could move around at will, unquote. They were encouraged to form a unit termed a, quote, general staff cell, unquote, first within G2's historical research section, and then later in the 7th Army's Intelligence Center in Wiesbaden, where they worked in private quarters and were treated as VIPs. Very important section coming up here. Indeed, a partly declassified CIA document recapitulated this story in the early 1970s, noting that at this time, quote, Galen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, D-O-E-N-I-T-Z, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Galen and the Admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Galen sought and received approval from Dönitz to, unquote. And Oglesby goes on to comment, in other words, the German chain of command was still in effect, and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans. And in a footnote, he goes on to add, that is, Oglesby goes on to add, as Galen was about to leave for the United States, he left a message for Hermann Bonn, that was one of his aides, with another of his top aides, Gerhard Wessel, W-E-S-S-E-L. I would note that Gerhard Wessel ultimately became head of the BND after Galen resigned. Quote, I am to tell you from Galen that he has discussed with Hitler's successor, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and Galen's superior and chief of staff, General Franz Halder, H-A-L-D-E-R, the question of continuing his work with the Americans. Both were in agreement, unquote. So, in addition to Karl Dönitz, Hitler's successor, Galen's chief of staff and superior, General Franz Halder, also approved of what Galen was doing, and again, the importance of this couldn't be exaggerated, and as Oglesby comments quite rightly, in other words, the German chain of command was still in effect, and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans. I don't doubt that one bit. Continuing now with Oglesby's account from Covert Action Information Bulletin. Galen's biographers are under the impression that it took 6 weeks for someone in European G2 to notice and recognize Galen in the POW cage, that Siebert did not tell Smith about finding him until the middle of August, and that it was much later, still before Siebert and Smith conspired to circumvent Eisenhower and communicate their excitement about Galen to someone at the Pentagon, presumably associated with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. but documents released in the 1980s show that this part of Galen's story raced along much more quickly. Already on June 29th, in fact, the Pentagon had informed Eisenhower's European command that the War Department wanted to see Galen in Washington. But by the way, I would interject at this point, in all probability, Siebert himself had the okay from people even higher than Eisenhower. General Siebert would not have disobeyed the orders of a five-star general unless he had been able to go around him and go to a higher echelon. Continuing. It was a fast time. By no later than August 22nd, one of Galen's top associates, Hermann Baun, B-A-U-N, was forming what would become the intelligence and counterintelligence section of Galen's new organization. Galen himself, with retinue, was departing for Washington and General Beadle Smith's DC-3 for high-level talks with American military and intelligence officials. And the whole concept of the deal he was about to offer his conquerors had been approved by a Nazi chain of command that was still functioning, despite what the world thought and still does think was the Nazis' unconditional surrender. Galen arrived in Washington on August 24th with six of his top FHO aides and technical experts in tow. World War II had been over about a week, the war in Europe about 3.5 months. So again, take note here that Galen makes contact with General Edwin L. Siebert, who just happened to get this idea to use German officers from none other than Gero von Givernitz, one of the pivotal people we've been looking at tonight. And above all else, note the time frame here. Note how quickly this organization was being formed. By August 22nd, okay, the organization is being formed in a kind of concrete way. And again, the pivotal point here, take note that Admiral Karl Dönitz and General Franz Halder approve of what Galen is doing. So, in effect, Galen, here's where the Trojan horse concept can really be understood. Galen was acting in conjunction with a chain of command that, despite the official end of the war, was still functioning. So we're going to continue now with the next section of Carl Oglesby's article. And here we're going to take a look at some of the provisions of the secret treaty of Fort Hunt and some of the people who were involved in putting it together. Oglesby writes, "As Galen and his six men were en route from Germany to Washington, Donovan's OSS troubles became critical. On August 23rd, Admiral William Leahy, L-E-A-H-Y, chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the President's National Security Advisor, and a man who despised Donovan, advised Truman to order his budget director, Harold Smith, to begin a study of the intelligence question, stating, quote, this country wanted no Gestapo under any guise or for any reason, unquote. Truman may not have known that the Gestapo's Odessa heirs were landing in the lap of the Pentagon even as he spoke. Smith, in any case, responded to Truman's directive by asking Donovan for his OSS demobilization plans. Now, too late, Donovan tried to fight. The Galen Party, quote, Group 6, unquote, was checking out its very comfortable accommodations at Fort Hunt at the very moment at which Donovan, writing from a borrowed Washington office, fired back a memo to Smith defending the OSS and its right to live. Quote, among these assets of the OSS was establishment for the first time in our nation's history of a foreign secret intelligence service which reported information as seen through American eyes. As an integral and inseparable part of this service, there is a group of specialists to analyze and evaluate the material for presentation to those who determine national policy. Much more significant than the question of the adequacy of U.S. intelligence on the Soviet Union, however, was the question of civilian versus military control of the intelligence mission. Germany and England had fought this battle in the 19th century, the military capturing the intelligence role in Germany and the civilians maintaining a position in England. Throughout the summer and fall of 1945, this same battle raged in the U.S. government. The battle for intelligence control was indeed the background for the arrival of Galen and his six aides at Fort Hunt. The battle for intelligence control was indeed the background for the arrival of Galen and his six aides at Fort Hunt, where Galen's party was housed and Galen himself provided with an NCO butler and several white-jacketed orderlies. A momentous relationship was established at Fort Hunt, one that had the most profound effect on the subsequent evolution of United States foreign policy during an exceptionally difficult passage of world history. The period of the Cold War as a whole, and more especially its early formative years, from Galen's coming aboard the American Intelligence Service until he rejoined the West German Republic in 1955, was laden with the peril of nuclear war. By the way, I think that actually would have been 56, the formal incorporation of the Federal Republic. Continuing. On at least one occasion, in 1948, Galen almost convinced the United States that the Soviet Union was about to launch a war against the West and that it would be in the U.S. interest to preempt it. By the way, we're going to take a look at that next week. Clearly, it is important to know who made and authorized the decisions that led to our national dependency on a network of underground Nazis, yet because the relevant documents are still classified, this central part of the Galen story still cannot be reconstructed. By the way, I would also interject, for people that still think that perhaps this is a little bit too arcane to be talking about in 1992, take note that as of 1990, these documents about the Treaty of Fort Hunt were still classified. Continuing with Oglesby's account, from the handful of published books about the Galen affair, none of which cite their sources on this point, we can list only seven Americans who were said to be involved with Galen at Fort Hunt. Admiral William D. Leahy, Chief of Staff and Truman's National Security Advisor, a familiar name's about to come up, Alan Dulles, OSS Station Chief in Bern during the war, Sherman Kent, head of OSS Research and Analysis Branch and a Yale historian, General George V. Strong, head of Army G2, Major General Alex H. Bolling of G2, B-O-L-L-I-N-G, Brigadier General John T. Magruder, M-A-G-R-U-D-E-R, first head of the Army Strategic Services Unit of Vulture of OSS, and Loftus E. Becker, B-E-C-K-E-R, a lawyer associated with G2 and the Nuremberg War Crimes Operation, the CIA's first deputy director. We do not know if these people were involved as a committee, if they talked with Galen and his six aides a lot or a little, separately or all at once, or if they sent their own aides to work out the details. We do not know how a POW interrogation was transformed into a bargaining process. Above all, we do not know what kind of communication the U.S. participants in the Fort Hunt-Galen talks had with the political authorities to whom they were responsible. Leahy is the only one who had obvious contact with President Truman. But there is nothing in the revealed record to indicate that he ever discussed Galen or the Fort Hunt deal with Truman, or took the least trouble to explain to Truman the implications of hiring a Nazi spy network. We have no idea, for that matter, how Leahy himself saw it. What we do know is the outlines of the Galen deal itself, however it was hammered out and however it was or was not ratified by legal political authority. That is because Galen himself laid out its terms in his autobiography, The Service. Galen says in this work, which has been attacked for its inaccuracies, that the discussions ended with a, quote, gentleman's agreement, unquote, that the terms of his relationship with the United States were, quote, for a variety of reasons never set down in black and white, unquote. He continues, again quoting, such was the element of trust that had been built up between the two sides during this year of intensive such was the element of trust that had been built up between the two sides during this year of intensive personal contact that neither had the slightest hesitation in founding the entire operation on a verbal agreement and a handshake, unquote. Of course, as we've seen, this particular deal was the outgrowth of a long process of negotiation, much of which a long process of rapprochement, shall we say, which I've been outlining this evening, or detailing this evening. Continuing. According to Galen, this agreement consisted of the following six basic points. His language is worth savoring. Quote, I remember the terms of the agreement well, he wrote. One, a clandestine German intelligence organization was to be set up using the existing potential to continue information gathering in the East, just as we had been doing before. The basis for this was our common interest in a defense against communism. Two, this German organization was to work not for or under the Americans, but, quote, jointly with the Americans, unquote. Again, the Christian West concept. The organization would operate exclusively under German leadership, which would receive its directives and assignments from the Americans until a new government was established in Germany. Four, the organization was to be financed by the Americans with funds which were not to be part of the occupation costs, and in return the organization would supply all its intelligence reports to the Americans, unquote. Five, As soon as a sovereign German government was established, that government should decide whether the organization should continue to function or not, but that until such time, the care and control, later referred to as the trusteeship of the organization, would remain in American hands. Six, and this is very important, should the organization at any time find itself in a position where the American and German interests diverged, it was accepted that the organization would consider the interests of Germany first. And indeed, as we look back and we see the functioning of the Galen organization over the years, and we're going to take a look at how it screwed things up next week. We've already taken a look at how it helped screw up President Kennedy, but indeed, I think history will attest to just to how accurate this is. Again, quoting, should the organization at any time find itself in a position where the American and German interests diverged, it was accepted that the organization would consider the interests of Germany first. Take this and the fact that Galen was acting with the approval of a supposedly demobilized Third Reich command structure, and the degree to which the Galen organization can indeed be seen, as Oglesby has pointed out, not only as a vehicle for the Odessa, but beyond that, as a Trojan horse, the extent to which that can be accepted as true, I think, can be assessed at this point. We're going to continue. Galen acknowledges that the last point especially might, quote, raise some eyebrows, unquote, and make some think that the U.S. side, quote, had gone overboard in making concessions to us, unquote. He assures his readers that actually, quote, this point demonstrates better than any other Siebert's great vision. He recognized that for many years to come, the interests of the United States and West Germany must run parallel. Unquote. Galen and his staff left Fort Hunt for Germany on July 1, 1946, having been in the United States almost a year. They were temporarily based at Oberursel, then settled into a permanent base in a walled-in, self-contained village at Pulach near Munich. Oberursel is O-B-E-R-U-R-S-E-L, Pulach is P-U-L-L-A-C-H. Galen set up his headquarters in an estate originally built by Martin Bormann. There, a startup group of 50 began to turn the, quote, gentleman's agreement, unquote, of Fort Hunt into a reality. The first order of business being staff, Galen's recruiters were soon circulating among the unemployed mass of former Nazi SS men, the Odessa constituency, to find more evaluators, couriers, and informers. Galen had, quote, solemnly promised in Washington not to employ SS and Gestapo men, unquote, although it will be noted that Galen includes no such provision in his list of terms. There is not the least question that he did recruit such men, supplying them with new names when necessary. Recall that in Radio Free America shows 1, 2, and 3 and others, we've taken a look at the liberal use, the massive use, of SS and Gestapo veterans in the Galen organization. Of this, Oglesby writes, two of the worst of them were Franz Sieks, S-I-X, and Emil Augsburg, A-U-G-S-B-U-R-G. Sieks was a key Nazi intellectual, and both Sieks and Augsburg were associated with the Wannsee Institute, the Nazi think tank in Berlin, where SS leader Reinhard Heydrich, in January of 1942, announced, quote, the final solution to the Jewish question, unquote. Both of them had commanded extermination squads roving in East Europe in pursuit of Jews and communists, and both had gone underground with the Odessa when the Third Reich crumbled. Augsburg hid in Italy, then returned in disguise when Galen called. Sieks was actually captured by Allied intelligence, tried at Nuremberg, and imprisoned, only to be sprung to work with Augsburg running Galen's networks of East European Nazis. I would add that the person who sprung Franz Alfred Sieks, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 2, was none other than John J. McCloy, the U.S. High Commissioner for Germany, who also, along with Alan Dulles, served on the Warren Commission. Continuing. From the edge of total defeat, Galen now moved into his vintage years more powerful, influential, and independent than he had ever been in the heyday of the Third Reich. Minimally supervised first by the War Department Strategic Services Unit under Fort Hunt figure Major General John Magruder, and then by the SSU's follow-on organization, the Central Intelligence Group under Rear Admiral Sidney Sauers, S-O-U-E-R-S, the org grew to dominate the entire West German intelligence service. Through his close ties to Chancellor Konrad Adenauer's chief minister, Hans Globke, Galen was able to place his men in positions of control in West Germany's military intelligence and the internal counterintelligence arm. When NATO was established, he came to dominate it, too. By one estimate, quote, some 70%, unquote, of the total intelligence take flowing into NATO's military committee and Allied headquarters shape on the Soviet Union, the countries of East Europe, and the rest of Europe, and indeed, the rest of the world, was generated at Pulak. Not even the establishment of the CIA in 1947 and the official transfer of the Pulak operation into the West German government in July of 1955, when it was retitled the Federal Intelligence Service, or BND, lessened the reliance of American intelligence on Galen's product. The last sentence again, not even the establishment of the CIA in 1947 and the official transfer of the Pulak operation into the West German government in July of 1955, when it was retitled the Federal Intelligence Service, BND, lessened the reliance of American intelligence on Galen's product. From the beginning days of the Cold War through the 1970s and beyond, the United States, West Germany's, and NATO's most positive beliefs about the nature and intentions of the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, and world communism would be supplied by an international network of utterly unreconstructed SS Nazis whose primary purposes were to cover the escape of the Odessa and make the world safe for Nazism. So once again, reviewing some of the central points of this last section, note we have our old buddy Alan Dulles hook right up there with the group that was negotiating with Reinhard Galen and working out the Fort Hunt Treaty. And we don't really know what was said because the documents still were classified as of 1990. Note again that when German and American interests were perceived as diverging, it was understood that the Galen organization, at least according to Galen, and who should know better than he was in a position to control, that the organization would act on behalf of German interests first. And boy, did they do that. I would also note again that the Galen organization was not only the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, sole purveyors of intelligence on that part of the world, but even after it became the BND, we remained dependent on it for our view of what was going on, and also, obviously, it then became the West German Intelligence Service as well. This organization, the Galen organization, wielded an enormous effect on the post-World War II history. Again, it was at the center of our own intelligence system, and as we will look at next week, it badly warped our own perceptions of what was going on in the world. It basically functioned as the eyes and ears for NATO, and as it was helping to shape NATO, and after it was already deeply shaping U.S. perceptions of the Cold War, it was installed as the West German Intelligence Service. And as we'll see next week, it also, elements, Galen-related elements, became involved in domestic American politics, some of these Third Reich émigré, and ultimately, on November 22, 1963, these elements took a most active role in American politics. Namely, they participated in the assassination of President Kennedy. The last section of Oglesby's article is called The Cost of the Fort Hunt Treaty. And it reads, Galen's story has many branchings beyond this point. These include several key spy scandals that exposed his organization as dangerously vulnerable to Soviet penetration. They include the pitiful spectacle of U.S. CIC agents pursuing Nazi fugitives on war crimes charges, only to see them summarily pardoned and hired by Galen. They include the dark saga of Klaus Barbie, the SS Butcher of Lyon, unquote, who worked with the Galen organization and boasted of being a member of the Odessa. They include aspects of Operation Paperclip, in which right-wing forces in the U.S. military once again savaged the concept of denazification in order to smuggle scores of SS rocket scientists into the United States. By the way, we're going to take a look at the role of the paperclip people also in the winning of World War II for the Third Reich during the course of this broadcast. Continuing. They include continuation of the civilian versus military conflict over the institution of secret intelligence and the question of politically motivated covert action within the domestic interior. Note this. The continuation of the civilian versus military conflict over the institution of secret intelligence and the question of politically motivated covert action within the domestic interior. We saw that with the assassination of John Kennedy and other things. They include, continuing with Oglesby's account, They include, above all, the story of the enormous victory of the Odessa in planting powerful Nazi colonies around the world, in such countries as South Africa, where the enactment of apartheid laws followed, or several countries in Latin America that then became breeding grounds for the death squads of the current day, and indeed even in the United States, where it now appears that thousands of wanted Nazis were able to escape justice and grow old in peace. In making the Galen Deal, the United States did not acquire for itself an intelligence service. That is not what the Galen Group was, or was trying to be. The military intelligence historian Colonel William Corson, C-O-R-S-O-N, put it most succinctly, quote, "Galen's organization was designed to protect the Odessa Nazis. It amounts to an exceptionally well-orchestrated diversion," unquote. The only intelligence provided by the Galen Net to the United States was intelligence selected specifically to worsen East-West tensions and increase the possibility of military conflict between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It was exactly as the right-wing papers had warned in 1945 when they were aroused by Donovan's proposal for a permanent intelligence corps, warning their readers that a, quote, super spy unit, unquote, could again, quoting, determine American foreign policy by weeding out, withholding, or coloring information gathered at his direction, unquote. It was exactly as Truman had warned when he demobilized the OSS, with the observation that the U.S. had no interest in, quote, Gestapo-like measures, unquote. The fact that this lively concern for a police state apparatus should have been focused on the relatively innocuous OSS, while at the same time the red carpet was being rolled out for Galen's gang of SS men, must surely count as one of the supreme, wrenching ironies of the modern period. Another dimension of the cost of the Galen Deal is the stress it induced within American institutions, weakening them incalculably. The Galen organization was the antithesis of the Allied cause, its sinister emergence on the scene of post-war Europe, the very opposite of what the Western democracies thought they had been fighting for. Perhaps at least we can say that despite Galen, and despite the military, the United States did, after all, finally wind up with a civilian intelligence service. The National Security Act of 1947 did embody Donovan's central point in creating a CIA outside the military. But in fact, the Galen Org substantially preempted the CIA's civilian character before it was ever born. The CIA was born to be rocked in Galen's cradle. It remained dependent on the Org even when the Org turned into the BND. Thus, whatever the CIA was from the standpoint of the law, it remained from the standpoint of practical intelligence collection a front for a house of Nazi spies. The Org was not merely military, which is bad, not merely foreign, which is much worse, and not merely Nazi, which is intolerable. It was not even professionally committed to the security of the U.S. and Western Europe. It was committed exclusively to the security of the Odessa. All the Galen Org ever wanted the U.S. to be was anti-communist. The more militantly so, the better. It never cared in the least for the security of the United States, its Constitution, or its democratic tradition. It is not the point of this essay that there would have been no Cold War if the Odessa had not wanted it and had not been able, through the naive collaboration of the American military right, to place Galen and his network in a position that ought to have been occupied by a descendant of the OSS. But it was precisely because the world was so volatile and confusing as of the transition from World War II to peacetime that the U.S. needed to see it, as Donovan put in his plaintive appeal to Truman in the summer of 1945, quote, through American eyes, unquote. No Nazi eyes, however bright, could see it for us without deceiving us and leading us to the betrayal of our own national character. Second, there was no way to avoid the Cold War once we had taken the desperate step of opening our doors to Galen. From that moment on, from the summer of 1945, when the Army brought him into the United States and made a secret deal with him, the Cold War was locked in. A number of Cold War historians on the left, for example, D.F. Fleming and Gabriel Kolko, K-O-L-K-O, have made cogent arguments that from the Soviet point of view, the Cold War was not inevitable even as late as 1947. According to standard American history, in fact, it was only in 1947 that the Cold War was thrust upon us by an irrational and belligerent Stalin. The story of the secret treaty of Fort Hunt exposes this, quote, history, unquote, as a self-serving political illusion. On the contrary, the war in the Pacific was still raging, and the United States was still trying to get the Soviet Union into the war against Japan when General Siebert was already deep into his relationship with Galen. The key point that comes crashing through the practical and moral confusion about this matter once one sees that Galen's organization was an arm of the Odessa is that whether it was ethical or not, the U.S. did not pick up the gift horse in Galen at all. It picked up a Trojan horse. The unconditional surrender the Germans made to the Allies, the unconditional surrender the Germans made to the Allied command at the Little Red Schoolhouse in Rheims was the surrender only of the German armed services. It was not the surrender of the hard SS corps of the Nazi Party. The SS did not surrender, unconditionally or otherwise, and thus Nazism itself did not surrender. The SS chose, rather, to seek other means of continuing the war, while the right wing of the United States military establishment, through fears and secret passions and a naivete of its own, chose to facilitate that choice. The history that we have lived through since then stands witness to the consequences. And a few quotes from this last section of the article, I think, sum up the Galen organization. And next week and in the next 2 weeks, we're going to take a look at just how this was done. And in viewing how this was done, we will see the formation of the milieu that we were looking at in Peter Dale Scott's brilliant manuscript, The Dallas Conspiracy, this petroleum, intelligence, Third Reich, American far-right national security milieu, of which George Bush was part and parcel. This milieu is in charge of the destiny of this country and the world to this day. A few sections of the concluding section of Oglesby's article that I think are worth reiterating. One where he quotes Colonel William Corson, a military intelligence historian, also an advisor, I believe, to the Church Committee. Quote, Galen's organization was designed to protect the Odessa Nazis. It amounts to an exceptionally well-orchestrated diversion. Unquote. The only intelligence provided by the Galen net to the United States was intelligence selected specifically to worsen East-West relations and increase the possibility of military conflict between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Skipping down, another dimension of the cost of the Galen deal is the stress it induced within American institutions, weakening them incalculably. The Galen organization was the antithesis of the Allied cause, its sinister emergence on the scene of post-war Europe, the very opposite of what the Western democracies thought they had been fighting for, and skipping down again. But in fact, the Galen org substantially preempted the CIA's civilian character before it was ever born. The CIA was born to be rocked in Galen's cradle. It remained dependent on the org, even when the org turned into the BND. Thus, whatever the CIA was from the standpoint of the law, it remained from the standpoint of practical intelligence collection a front for a house of Nazi spies. And again, of the Galen organization, the org was not merely military, which is bad, not merely foreign, which is much worse, and not merely Nazi, which is intolerable. It was not even professionally committed to the security of the U.S. and Western Europe. It was committed exclusively to the security of the Odessa. All the Galen org ever wanted the U.S. to be was anti-communist, the more militantly so, the better. It never cared in the least for the security of the United States, its Constitution, or its democratic national, or its democratic tradition. And again, the conclusion, the SS did not surrender unconditionally or otherwise. By the way, Reims here is R-E-I-M-S, that's a city in France. The unconditional surrender of the Germans made to the Allied command at the Little Red Schoolhouse in Reims was the surrender only of the German armed services. It was not the surrender of the hard SS corps of the Nazi Party. The SS did not surrender unconditionally or otherwise, and thus Nazism itself did not surrender. The SS chose, rather, to seek other means of continuing the war while the right wing of the United States military establishment, through fears and secret passions and a naivete of its own, chose to facilitate that choice. The history that we have lived through since then stands witness to the consequences. Well, to that I would, of course, add that this naivete of the American military right wing cannot be seen but in the context of the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that we've been looking at this evening. And again, the NATO organization, at the apex of which, the Galen organization, again, basically an Odessa front for all practical purposes, a Trojan horse, the NATO organization at the core of which the Galen organization was placed, was basically a development of the Christian West concept, which we saw both German and American intelligencers themselves part and parcel to this transatlantic industrial and financial axis. We saw them forming it during World War II. What we're going to look at next week is just exactly how the Galen organization affected the Cold War, how it affected American perceptions and operations, and how it affected American domestic political life, and ultimately the effects of the Galen organization on American domestic political life peaked and reached a crescendo with the assassination of John Kennedy on 11/22/63. We've already taken a look in the first two installments of this archive show at the presence of Galen and ABN-related elements in that particular action, namely the assassination of President Kennedy. And again, in evaluating the Galen organization, not only was it our exclusive purveyor of intelligence to Eastern Europe, it was, for all practical purposes, the NATO intelligence organization, and then when it became the West German CIA, basically the BND, it still was our main purveyor of intelligence on that part of the world. The effects of an organization like that, and in particular with its explicit Nazi character, could not be exaggerated, and its incorporation, as we will see during the next few installments, at least two more, possibly three, of this archive show, it was the vehicle for winning World War II for the Reich, and its incorporation into the United States as a result of the events that we've been studying and the processes we've been studying so far was the dominant factor in determining how the United States lost the Second World War.